sing it for us in a moment. But first, take us back to the time when you brought this thing of beauty into the world.
Well, I had gone broke. I had had a huge hit record when I was 15 years old in the States. And so, of course, it was all downhill from there. I was a has-been by the time I was 16, and I had had to move back in with my mother in my early 20s. And I felt like the least I could do, because it was horribly embarrassing to have to move back home, was to work on my writing. And I was sitting at her kitchen table one day, and I was playing the guitar, and I was playing this little figure on it. And I was reading the New York Times, and the magazine section had a story about a debutante. And she said that she had learned the truth at 18. And it just sounded like such a great idea. I learned the truth at 18, but it didn't scan. So I wound up being at 17.
You took a liberty with the age.
I did.
And how long did it take to write then?
It took 3 months. It was a hard song to write. I think with a song like that, you can go one of two ways. You can either write it to be precious and self-indulgent and talk about how fabulously you turned out. And, you know, one day she woke up and her skin was clear and she was saving the whales and a beautiful, handsome prince came and rescued her. Or you can tell the truth, which is, it's a crappy age. Yeah. It's a horrible thing to be going through. Nobody is having a good time. And you hopefully turn into the swan from The Ugly Duckling. So it took a long time because I didn't want the song to be false in any way, shape, or form. And it's difficult because the human tendency is to embellish.
Yeah, but you wanted it to be down the line, straight down the line, exactly to reflect exactly what you were writing about.
To go to the heart.
Yeah, and a lot of people would have made the presumption, of course, that it was autobiographical.
Well, yeah, of course. Mm. I mean, I was on the road by the time I was 15, so I didn't go to a prom, but there are plenty of times in anyone's life when you're standing outside with your nose pressed against the glass looking in, watching everyone else dance. And one of the wonderful and horrible things about being a writer is that you're the one who gets to write about that rather than participate most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, without further ado, because I'm sure there are thousands listening who would love to hear it, there'll be people who are going to work in a few minutes. Now, we'll continue the discussion after this wonderful song. Here's Janice Ian.
Thanks.
Live on the John Murray Show with At 17.
I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired. The valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems. At 17, a brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said pity please the ones who serve, 'cause they only get what they deserve. In the rich relation, hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. So remember those who win the game, lose the love they sought to gain, in debentures of quality and dubious integrity. Their small town eyes will gape at you in dull surprise when payment due exceeds accounts received. At 17,
To those of us who knew the pain of Valentines that never came, and those whose names were never called when choosing sides for basketball. It was long ago and far away, and the world was younger than today, when dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. We all play the game, and when we dare, we cheat ourselves at solitaire, inventing lovers on the phone, repenting other lives unknown. They call and say, come on, dance with me, and murmur vague obscenities at ugly girls like me at 17.
To give us a I should try it.
just a verse. Jesse, the floors and the boards, recalling your steps, and I remember too. Lord, the pictures are fading, and they are shaded in gray, but I still set a place on the table at noon, and I'm leaving a light on the stairs. No, I am not scared. I wait for you. Hey, Jesse, I'm lonely. Come home. I tell you, the terrible thing about writing something like Jesse is that you spend the rest of your life chasing it.
And Janice, you're going to sing another song for us?
I am. I went on tour with Mary Black years ago, and it was fascinating because we were in a bus, and it was herself and myself and her 7-year-old then daughter, Siobhan, and she was beginning to teach Siobhan history, and I was fascinated because it was as though everything was happening in that very moment. Very much like my people who are Jewish teach history to us when we're young. So when we got to Dublin, I was staying in a very tall hotel. I was on the 3rd floor, and I was looking out over the roofs at the people and the cats, and I wrote this. Mary's eyes are startling blue, and her hair's Newcastle gold, and she walks the fine white line between the body and the soul. She's as faithful to her history as a novice to his fast, for she stands upon the bones of Ireland's past. She is singing of the troubles and a fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her how the spirit still shines through, that she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart into. Mary is wise as she is foolish, she's as constant as the tide. It's a woman's heart that beats beneath that stubborn Irish pride. We are saints and we are sinners, we are heroes, we are thieves, but we are all of us beginners on
on the road to Galilee. We are singing of our troubles and a fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her that the Spirit still shines through, and she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart in two. So let us hoist a pint of silence to the east where Ireland lies, and we will gaze across the waters for a glimpse of Mary's eyes. We are ships without a harbor, we are sailors on dry land, and the song goes on forever, even though the record can't. We are singing of our troubles and a fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her how the Spirit still shines through, that she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart in two.
Wonderful, Dennis and Michael, for providing a wonderful contemplative hour for us all. Mark Dwyer was in sound, Elizabeth Larrigy produced, Pat Kenny is up next, I'm back. We're in Tala actually Monday morning for more Operation Transformation, following our hearts. Slán.
We're married in London but not in New York. Spain says we're kosher, the States say we're pork. We went in Toronto and the judge said amen, and when we got home we were single again. It's hard being married and living in sin. Sometimes I forget just which state I am in. Thank God I'm not Catholic, I'd be a mess trying to figure out what to confess. My passport in Sweden says I've got a wife. Amsterdam tells me I'm partnered for life. But back in America, land of the free, I'm a threat to the national security. If I were a frog, here's what I would say. It's hard being green, it's hard being gay. For love has no color, and hearts have no sex. So love where you can, and bugger the rest.
First,
all right, that's all right, work away. So we're looking forward to that.
Great.
In your own time, please.
Right, yeah.
Truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles, married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me. murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems at 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, 'cause they only get what they deserve. And the rich relationed hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. Remember those who win the game, lose the love they sought to gain, in debentures of quality and dubious integrity. Their small town eyes will gape at you in dull surprise when payment due exceeds accounts received at 17. Of us who knew the pain of Valentine's that never came, and those whose names were never called when choosing sites for basketball. It was long ago and far away. The world was younger than today, when dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. We all play the game, and when we dare, we cheat ourselves at solitaire, inventing lovers on the phone, repenting other lives unknown. The call and say, come and dance with me, and murmur vague obscenities at ugly girls like me at 17.
That is so absolutely beautiful, Janice. A song can get better, and a voice can get better
It's pretty early to be singing.
It is a little bit early, but your voice sounds remarkably pure and strong and beautiful. Much love coming in for you on text. You must be well used to striking such a strong bond.
It's making a great song for bond. That. You know, people just really, it stuns me every time.
It's fantastic. Peter asked me about your guitar.
It's a, it's as pretentious as this sounds. It's a Santa Cruz Janice Ian model.
Yeah.
And if you go to my website, which is janiceian.com, and you go to, I think, tour and then equipment, we tell all about it.
All right, brilliant. Janice, you said there are some seats left for Vicar Street that won't be for very much longer.
Well, I hope not. I mean, as selfish as that sounds, it's always good to have a sold-out house.
It's a great venue.
It is a fabulous venue. Nice folks, too.
Hope you enjoy it. Janice, an absolute pleasure. I can't say how much that meant to be hearing this morning and being in the room with you as you played it.
Will
live with me forever.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Janice Healy. That will be up. We'll give you a chance to listen to it on the website later on as well. So it's got 11:35.
Questions, and we'll find out how she got on. Around about a quarter past, 20 past three.
I should point out that you got back from Belfast at four this morning.
That's true, there was that frog at the end of the song.
To be able to perform so wonderfully this early.
Something.
And nodding in admiration is writer Michael Harding. Michael.
Hi, Michael.
You've been listening and looking, and it's as if the 37 years since Janice wrote the song hadn't passed.
That's right.
It's as fresh as the first day I heard it.
I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm sitting in a studio with Janice Ian. I'm so happy
to
meet you. If Janice knew the amount of times I stood in front of an old black box high fidelity, we thought it was a machine, you know, and mouthing the words of that song. And I was a boy. Do you know what I mean?
It's one of the things that stunned me about it, because when I wrote it, and I really, the first two or three months I sang it on stage, I sang it with my eyes closed because I was so sure that everybody would be laughing at me, because I was convinced I was the only one who felt that way.
Yeah.
But the other astonishing thing was how many boys were affected, because as a girl growing up, you think boys have it easy. You know, well, gosh, they're the ones who get to ask you out, you know? It's all in your hands. You never think, it's all in your hands. How hard is that?
Well, there are lines in it like, you know, those who don't get picked for basketball. Mm. And every boy identifies with that, the terror of the playground at lunchtime when you had to go out to play football and stand there to pick teams and be the one that nobody picked or be the last one in the line.
Be worse for a boy, wouldn't it?
And then leave, you know? Yeah. And there's another line in it. Those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately
remained
at home.
Inventing lovers on the phone.
I really think that song is a powerful poem. I think that Janis really is a great lyric poet. You know, there's Van Morrison, there's Christy Moore, but Janis Ian, you know, opened a door. She opened a space in conversation for people that never was opened before. And what she opened was that up until then, when you watch Top of the Pops, which was our show.
Top of the Pops, I know it.
All the songs, all the stories were about I'm going to score, or I scored and it was wonderful, hey, dum-de-dum-de-dum, you know. And suddenly there was a beautiful woman, a beautiful young girl, saying, I didn't score, and I feel uneasy about myself. Now, to confess that, to open up that shame, if you like, opened it up and opened up a space of conversation and I think a space of tenderness for maybe tens of thousands of people.
Mm. You know. It's a marvellous thing.
How were you conscious at the time, Janis, when you wrote the song and the immediate aftermath of it becoming a hit? Were you conscious of the impact that it was having?
No. Not like it's become. My teacher, Stella Adler, used to say that writers are born knowing, and then she would often follow it up with, it's a pity you have no idea that you're born knowing, but you're born knowing. And I think that's where the talent comes in. You know, talent is, it's a grace. It's something you're born with. It's not something that you merit or that you do anything for. You. It's like sitting on the back of a runaway horse and hoping you don't fall off most of the time. But it's the talent that comes up with the phrases like lacking in the social graces, or that says, I'm not sure why that feels right, but it feels right because it strikes some chord in my heart. And then it's the bravery that takes the leap and says, so I'm going to go ahead and put that in the song and trust my talent.
Trust your talent. But you'd already trusted your talent, because the thing about you is, Janis, at the age of 17, you had already lived what could be, I think, accurately described as an extraordinary life. Because
I had. Just
give us a summary of, well, first of all, your parents, they were constantly under the gaze of the FBI.
They were. My father was a farmer when I was growing up. My mother was a waitress. But they were both active in the civil rights movement, so they were very much under the eye of the FBI, who kept the whole family under surveillance and would hang around their mailbox pretending that they weren't there. And you could always spot them, because in the heat of August, they would be standing there in suits and ties, you know?
A giveaway.
Right. So that was something, because my dad then became a teacher, but he could never get what we call tenure, which is the lifetime contract, because after 2 years, the FBI would come in and ask whether he had been seen consorting with communists, and that was the end of that. So it was very much a hidden public life, if you will.
Mm.
And I began writing when I was just old enough to write. Like most kids, I think, I wrote poetry and wrote my deep thoughts, you know, in my journals. But then I picked up a guitar at 10 after studying piano all my life and felt at home. There's a connection. It's a almost druidic connection between the wood and the heart that happens when you play with a guitar pressed against you, that then comes out through your voice. And I started writing when I was 12. I wrote my first song at 12. I was published at 13. I made a record at 14. I had a hit at 15. As it has been at 16.
And it was no ordinary hit. It was a song called Society's Child.
It was. It was about a black boy dating a white girl. And it was interesting what Michael was saying, because I'd never heard it put that way, to, and what you were saying, to open a conversation, because That's what Society's Child did. It dropped into the middle of the civil rights movement in America, and suddenly families were talking about, well, what would you do if your daughter brought one home over the coffee table? And apparently that hadn't been done before, and it really ignited a storm. People were very angry.
I think it was banned in
it was banned yeah. pretty much everywhere, and where it wasn't banned, in Atlanta, Georgia, for instance, a radio station played it and was burned and down to the ground.
And you speak in your autobiography, at the beginning of your autobiography, about a particular concert you played. Tell us about the audience.
It was a sold-out concert. I was all of 15 and a half, I think, and I started to sing Society's Child, and a group of people, I later realized, had bought tickets to boo me off the stage. And they started screaming "Nigger Lover" at me, and began a chant like this: "Nigger Lover, Nigger Lover, beat, beat, beat," until I finally walked off the stage in tears. Fortunately for me, the promoter really demanded that I go back and face them, and that was the best thing I could have done for myself, because it was an immediate lesson in the power of music, that it could. That it could anger people so much that they would do something like that to a 15-year-old, and yet the rest of the audience could then get so angry in turn that they would shut them up.
Mm. And you haven't looked back since you went back on the concert stage that night. You haven't looked back.
Well, it's part of why I started staying after shows and signing autographs about 15 years ago. I realized that I was scared of my audience because I went through 3 years of that, of people screaming at me or tripping me on my way up stage or death threats, and I decided not to be scared anymore.
Michael, at 17.
At 17?
You were a vulnerable young man, were you?
I was happy.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, I think the reason I was happy was because at 16 I wasn't happy. At 16, I used to go to Donegal, and I had a girlfriend at the time, and we used to meet in the Gaeltacht in Donegal, and I got my first kiss on a wall in... Aranmore Island in Donegal from a girl from Navan. But anyway, my girlfriend and I kind of separated, and I was facing into the Leaving Cert at that moment, you know, coming on to 17. And my brother, I have one brother, and he went away to college that year, so I was now going to be an only child with my two parents. And my mother said that to replace the son, she had decided to take in two boarders. And I said, what do they do? And she said, they're students. And I said, where? And she said, in Loretto. And I thought, there's two girls, Loretto girls, coming here. And she said, yeah, they're from Donegal. And the idea that two Donegal girls were going to be sitting kind of around me for about a year and a half made me at 17 very happy. And I became very intimate with them. And they were like sisters. And I loved them, and I still love them, Kathleen and Anna. I won't say their second names. But, like, you know, I had no girls up until then in my life.
Sure, it's a huge
And all
thing.
Of a sudden, you'd go into their bedroom and there'd be, you know, to quote a famous American writer, that, you know, there'd be a bra hanging like a dead rabbit from the door from the door handle, you know. You couldn't take your eyes off it, you know.
Well, and, that age is so hard on a boy, too.
And the hot water was always going, they were always showering. And I was just... At 17, I have to say, I was really in heaven. But I heard that song at 17, maybe 4 or 5 years later, when, you know, darkness had set in. And when, as I say, it opened up conversations of kind of tenderness and the ability to say, you know, things don't really go right when you're 18 or 19 or 17. Mm. But it's not a shameful thing, and you can say it.
Right.
And can I mention another?
Sure.
There's one other... Every song on that album, Between the Lines, every song on it is beautiful, and that album is still available, by the way. You can get it anywhere. But there was another song, and when I was a student in college in the mid-70s, and we'd have student parties in houses, you know, where there was no furniture, and everybody would be sitting around, and there was one particular girl, woman, let's call, 29-year-old, that was a woman to us, and she wouldn't sing... You know, through all the other songs, guitars would be going, and Only Our Rivers Run Free, and all those songs. But it'd have to be about 2 in the morning, and somebody would eventually say, "I'm Mary for a song." And she'd nod like, "Okay, you're worthy of it now." And there's only one song she ever sang, and that was Jessie. And it is such, again, a lyrical poem. Yeah. It's such a fluid line in it, where the music and the words go together. And it says things like, Jesse, I'm lonely, come home.
Would you give us a verse or two of it?
Oh, my God.
Janice? We hadn't heard. We hadn't heard morning, that, yeah. Again, honest, open, not confession, but kind of revelation of who I am. Yeah. And when Janice talks about the thing of grace, that it needs to be grace coming through an artist, I think that's true. I think the universe conspires to make Janice Ian a wonderful person. But it also takes Janice in her own moment in life to control that grace, to accept it and to be generous with it. And that's what you hear when you hear her music and you hear her songs.
I'm going to be very full of myself in another minute.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
I mean, I know I'm fabulous, but this is even more fabulous than even
it
I realised.
It might be too difficult a task to ask you.
And after that song was always sung, the conversation changed.
Did it?
The wildness of the party was gone, and it was 2 a.m., and that song was sung, and it opened up the kind of conversations that young people have when they really get open and intimate and tender.
Isn't that
it's
great?
Such a beautiful song.
It's the power of music in particular, but of art in general, I think.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it stands between us and the chaos that surrounds us.
Yeah.
And it enfolds us and protects
us. And it's having an impact on our listeners, Janice. I can tell you, Siobhan in Cork says, I'm here in tears.
Siobhan.
It brings back so many memories of my teens. Thank you, Janice. Thanks so much. Mary says, you've made my week, Janice. The years have rolled away and I'm ageless. What a feeling.
Oh, come to Vicar Street. We'll talk about it.
Vicar Street on Sunday. And there are some tickets still available for the Vicar Street concert on Sunday. And Dawn says, goosebumps listening to Janice.
Sweet.
She could have written that song just for me. And just an email then from one of our listeners, Nolene in Wicklow. A little anecdote about Janice is at 17. We lived in Canada in the early 80s, and unlike today, we were completely isolated from our family in Ireland. No internet, no Skype, no texts, very infrequent telephone calls, but we wrote and received many, many lovely, long, newsy letters. My youngest sister was in her teens when we left and was growing up so quickly. When I heard at 17, shortly after we emigrated, all I could think about was her being 17 and how much I was missing her. So I went straight out and bought the LP for her, wrapped it so carefully and posted it off. I couldn't wait for her reply, which incidentally took weeks because she had to receive the parcel first, then reply by snail mail. Eventually she wrote and thanked me, but she didn't sound over enthusiastic. I was a bit disappointed, but forgot about it. Years later, when we returned to Ireland, we were listening to the radio together and heard Janice's at 17. And I reminded her of us being in Canada at that time and remember her being 17 and sending the LP. I knew there was a scale coming. It transpired that by the time the LP eventually got through the very slow postal system, it arrived completely warped and unplayable.
No.
So she didn't get to hear the song when she was 17 and not for many years afterwards. So while I still cherish a lovely memory of this song and my sister at 17, my sister had no memories of it whatsoever. But a person who had a big impact when we mentioned that you were coming in this morning was Margaret Joyce. She said, I was listening to your show, walking the Powerscourt estate here in County Wicklow, and when you mentioned Janice, my heart skipped a beat and my memories came flooding back of all those years ago. The song, even now, is still so profound and sends my thoughts and feelings into a spin of memories. And she goes on to say that while at 17, the lyrics applied to her life in the years subsequent to that, she was, I suppose, to summarise, in a happier place, and that you realise love does come eventually, and when it does, it is in the form of a wonderful husband who is also my best friend, not to mention my three darling children, one of who is a bit away from 17, and I already want to prevent her pain. That's from Margaret Joyce.
Sweet.
So there you are.
It's the fantastic thing about music, I think, as opposed to the other arts. You know, it's really the only invisible art. And it goes into us in a way that I think nothing else really does. And you can hear a snatch of a song and you remember exactly where you were when you heard it. And maybe it was your first kiss or the first time that you met your beloved or the first time somebody left you, you know.
Yeah.
But we live surrounded by music. It's astonishing.
Yeah, thank God. Thank God. Michael, by the way, there's a suggestion here that you replace Enda immediately, that you have a better way with words. A listener, don't do it. Don't do it, Michael. Stay with us. A listener wants to know about the make of your guitar and where you got it.
As pretentious as this sounds, it's a Janice Ian Model Santa Cruz. And if you want to know about it, you can go to my website, which is named after me. And you can go to the tour page and then equipment, I think. And you can read exactly what the guitar is and what I use in it.
Great.
They're very good guitars. And as Chet Atkins said, then after a point, it's in the fingers.
There's a great story also, though, about a guitar that you had, I think, that belonged to your father.
My dad's Martin, yeah. Yeah, we started on a farm, as I said. We were pretty broke. And a neighbor down the street's husband died. And while she was cleaning out the attic, she found this old guitar. And she said to my father, who she knew was studying music, did he want to buy the guitar? And he said, well, I don't know. What do you want for it? And she said, well, I guess $25 would do. And he said, well, all right. And so he brought home this guitar, and it was pretty beat up looking. And I grew up thinking, well, that's, you know, that's fine. Maybe someday I can afford a nice new one. And then one day I was hanging out with a bunch of guitarists, and I had brought it, and one of them said, that's a Martin D18. And I said, yeah, that's what it says on the top. It's a Martin. And they said, no, no, that's a really serious guitar. It sounds great. And so I went home, and I said, Dad, this is a Martin D18. And he went, yeah, that's what it says on the top. And so I grew up on this guitar. I wrote Society's Child and Jesse on it. And then when I was 21, I took it with me when I moved to the West Coast because I thought the weather would be better for it, and it was promptly stolen. Somebody jimmied the lock open in my apartment and took it. And for 26 years, on the back of every album, I put Martin Guitar, serial 67053, no questions asked. And for 26 years, I held on to a couple of other guitars, thinking, well, if somebody's got it, maybe I could trade. And 26 years, my partner and I had a big fight because we were going on vacation and I wanted to bring my computer and she didn't want me to. I brought it anyway and I got an email one morning and it said, I believe one of my customers has your guitar.
Go away.
And I called the guy, Eric, who owned a guitar shop, and he said, well, let me give you his number. His name's Jeff Grace, of all things. And I called, and his mother answered. And I thought, well, if his mother answers, then he can't be a thief. And we got to talking, and he said, yeah. He had read it in the back of a magazine. And he said, I thought for 15 minutes, and then I called three friends with big mouths so that I wouldn't be able to take it back. And in the end, he was a prince about it. He just said, I can't keep someone else's guitar. You can have it for what I've got in it. And I actually wound up sending him one of my guitars that he wanted. And we traded for it. So there's an article on my website called Of Guitars and Righteous Men about him.
After 26 years.
So miracles happen.
Well, the good news is Janice and Michael are still Mary's Eyes. When did you write that, Janice?
Must have been about 8 years ago, 10 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs. I just, and when I got home and I sang it for my partner, Pat, whose surname was Patton, and she's a redhead, and she said, what a beautiful song about Ireland. And I said, well, actually, I was thinking of Mary Black. And she said, were you really? I just thought it was all Irish women. And I thought, wow, isn't that a cool thing?
Fantastic.
What I get in that song, again, is Janice's vision or understanding of what an artist is doing. And that is, she almost can feel the famine slipping through her hands. It's like sorrow can be crafted into beauty. And that's the transformation. And I think that's what Janice Ian has. I think she must have lived spaces in her life that were, you know, deep and meaningful and possibly dark. And she has in each moment of that transformed them into lyric poems.
Good
song,
and I'm not even dead yet.
is he right? Is he right, Janice? Is he right?
I think so. I mean, I think that an artist takes everything. You know,
I think it's
your job
art
is to know
to
all art.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to create something that cuts through all of the barriers and goes straight to the heart. That's the goal. Mm. And when you've done that, that's funny. A girl was saying to me the other day after a show that she used to listen to the Backstreet Boys, but now she listened to real music. And I looked at her and I said, I love the Backstreet Boys. Mm. I mean, what great melodies, what great beats. And there's nothing wrong with any kind of art. You know, it's just what it is. You may not like it, but there's nothing wrong with any of it.
And Janice, you mentioned there your partner, Pat. You came out about 20 years ago or so, early 90s. And I think you were asked recently about the reaction of fans. One particular Irish fan was upset.
I had a long-time Irish fan, a lovely woman, and she was very upset. And this was before email, and she I came out because I was always out to my family and I was always out to the people I worked with, but the teenage suicide statistics in the States were that 3 out of every 10 teenage suicide attempts was because the child thought they might be gay. And the woman I was talking to said, "You never had a role model. Don't you think they deserve one?" And so I came out loudly in the press. And this woman from Ireland wrote to me and said that she was extremely disappointed in me, and my songs would never be the same to her, and she was going to get rid of all of my records. And I thought about it for a while, because at first I was offended, and then I thought, wait a minute, you know, it's just, it's ignorance speaking and fear. And I wrote back, and I said, you know, that's fine. Well, I hope you give them away instead of burning them. But if there was one thing you should have taken from my music, it was live and let live. And to her credit, because I think that's a very hard path, she thought about that, and she, about a month, 2 months later, wrote to me and said, you know, I've thought about it and thought about it, and you're right, it's really not my place, and it's really not my business, and it doesn't change the music. And I thought, good for you. And in fact, she has stayed just a marvelous fan and a friend to the foundation that my partner and I run, and is coming to Vicar Street. So it all worked out really
great.
Well.
Great.
People get upset over the strangest things. I mean, I would think that people would be much more worried about their rent and their family life than who I'm in bed with, really.
Yeah. No, it takes all...
And your partners and your parents and everyone else. I mean, the hardest thing is staying on the path. But I firmly believe that when you're on the right path, things fall into place. And it's when you get away from your heart that you begin to have the serious trouble.
And we were just talking during the break, Janice, about Irish audiences, and we have a lot of international performers going to Ireland, the best known musicians in the world, saying, oh, Irish audiences are great, and we take it with a pinch of salt. But you have good credentials on this, because I read an article that an interview you did in the United States.
US,
where you were asked, where is your favorite place on earth to perform?
And it is, it's Ireland.
Why is it?
You have a tradition of lyricism. You have a tradition of artistry that the only other place I'm aware of that has that same kind of feel to the audience is Wales. Ireland's one of the few countries where the entire audience may be singing at 17 back to me, and it's beautiful, and they're in tune.
Right. Give us another one.
Yeah. Well.
Let's quit the talking. And
yeah, this is, well, gosh. This is called Married in London, and I wrote it when London said that people like me and Pat could get married.
Great.
Because, of course, we can't at home.
I'll just say goodbye to our listeners, and thank you especially.
18 minutes past 11 o'clock, and I'm very happy to say that we're joined by Janice Ian in studio. Janice, good morning.
Good
how are
morning.
You today?
Alive and kicking.
how are you enjoying your jaunt around Ireland?
So far, it's been great. I can't believe the weather is this good.
Yeah, it's the best winter we've had in 350 years.
As they say about the Irish rain, you know that it's summer when the rain is warmer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you think it's an accident. We went to enormous expense.
I appreciate you not seeding the clouds while I'm here.
Your gigs are going well. How are the audiences?
Going well. Belfast was completely sold out. Rathose is completely sold out. Vicar Street is close to being sold out. So audiences are the best in the world. I mean, I know that's a cliche that performers supposedly always say, but... I think Irish and Welsh audiences are the best in the world.
Yeah, I think it is beyond a cliche. I think it's the truth. I think we love
absolutely.
It and we appreciate songs and we appreciate the words of songs.
Yeah, it's a tradition of lyrics.
Yeah.
And a tradition of lyricism.
And the Lord knows you're at the forefront of that.
I actually think Leonard Cohen is at the forefront of that. That's who we all strive to emulate.
Really?
Yeah.
He's the one you'd be listening to going, God, how does he do it?
Yes. Him and Lasse de Sella. Yeah.
Okay.
A few of them.
Very good. But you have been writing songs since you were literally out of the cradle almost, weren't you?
12, yeah.
How did it all start?
I started piano when I was 2 and a half.
Two and a half.
And I wanted to play. And so I started piano and we didn't have any money, so I had some very bad teachers. And I got very bored of playing the same thing over and over again. And knew that I wasn't going to be a concert pianist, as my family had desperately hoped. And so when I was 10, I went to summer camp, and a lot of the people played guitar, and I just fell in love, you know, and it was that thing, like what Keith Richards talks about in his autobiography, where suddenly the world disappears, and for 4 or 5 hours a day, it's just you and the instrument.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and then 2 years later, I wrote my first song.
This song that you have, Society's Child.
You're... I wrote that when I was 14.
All right, a little bit later then.
Yeah, I was already experienced.
You're an old hand.
I was an old hand.
Why did that song cause such a furore in America?
Well, it dropped right into the middle of the civil rights movement. And I expect it would have been like here during the Troubles with a Catholic and a Protestant. You know, it was just, A, it wasn't talked about, a black boy and a white girl. B, if it was talked about, it made people very angry. And so a lot of stations wouldn't play it. And those that did had their advertising withdrawn. One station was burned.
Wow.
People were fired. It was, it just became a lightning rod, I think.
Right. And was any of that directed towards you?
Oh, tons of it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I spent a couple of years with people tripping me as I was going on stage or spitting at me in the street or...
Oh, my God.
You know, you think I want to be famous so that people will come up and go, hey, are you Janice Ian? I love your work. Not, hey, are you Janice Ian? Poo.
What your parents must have thought, you know, I mean, they get you into a relatively safe hobby to have, playing the guitar.
Yeah,
you're up in your room, you're writing songs.
And bang.
The next minute, you're at the center of
it's
this.
World War III, yeah.
Unbelievable. And this all by the time you're 14.
Yeah. Well, but it was good in a way, you know. It was a really good lesson in the power of a song.
Which you've done time and time again, the power of songs. Now, that's a thing that just absolutely fascinates me, that you can create something that just... Oh, you know, it inhabits its own space afterwards. It's become so powerful.
Inhabits its own space. What a great way to say it.
A wonderful thing. Coming from you, that is the highest praise I've had on this show. Did you nearly become a vet? Is this a true story?
I was going to be a veterinarian and do music on the side. Well, because when I was a kid, you didn't make a living doing music. I mean, there were like 10 people in the universe who made a living doing music. And most of them were manufactured.
Mm.
You know, it was the Fabian and Frankie Avalon and etc., where you knew that they weren't singing their own songs, which I wanted to do. They weren't arranging or playing. They were good looking.
Yeah.
And so in the folk world, which is what I came from, you had people like Odetta or people like Pete Seeger, but they were such giants to me. I couldn't imagine being able to earn a living. So I was going to be a veterinarian like my dad. And then eventually I was going to do music on the side on the weekend.
And what happened? What changed that plan, Jesse?
No, you know, I think it was just, I couldn't imagine after a while doing anything but music.
Thank God for that.
It just didn't make sense. Well, thank you. And then I got my first paying gig when I was 13 and a half. It was $39 a weekend for 9 shows. The good old days. And my car fare cost me almost 20. So, and then I remember because I went out and I bought a pair of horrendous green boots and a hardcover book. I'd always wanted a hardcover book and we couldn't afford that.
Really?
So I bought a hardcover book. Yes, yeah, still have it.
In the day when a hardcover book was the thing to have.
It was the thing to have.
Believe.
It was huge.
When you're writing songs, that you know, do you remember writing particular songs? Do you remember writing at 17?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, I think I remember the start.
Yeah.
And sometimes the finish. Once in a great while, the process. It's a song called Some People's Lives that I wrote with Kai Fleming, where I really remember it line by line because it was so intense. At 17, took 3 months of labor.
Did it?
Yeah, it was a hard, Jesse too, just hard songs to get right.
How would they start with you? Where would it, you know, the
at
initial
17,
thread?
Just started with the little guitar figure that... I was fiddling with that. You know, I was very proud of myself that I had discovered the samba. And I was reading an article in the New York Times magazine at my mom's.
Yeah.
And it said the girl was saying that she had thought that when she came out as a debutante at 18, everything would be fine.
Yeah.
She would meet the man of her dreams. They would go off and get married and have 2.4 children. And she said, I learned the truth at 18.
Yeah.
I was wrong. And I remember, because I was thinking, I learned the truth at 18, and I thought, that's a great idea, but you can't sing it, really.
Yeah.
And so 17 fell into place.
Wow.
And then from there, it was off and running, and it was just a question of...
And what was going on over the 3 months, when you have this beautiful riff, and you have your opening phrase? Is it like stone carving? Is it like masonry, that the shape is in there, but you have to stick at it to find the rest of it?
I think so. Wasn't it Michelangelo who said that? He said that he didn't make statues, he took away what was not the statue.
So you were taking away what was not at 17.
Yeah, I think a song like 17 is hard, I think, because you're talking about something that's hard to talk about in the first place.
Mm.
And so it's difficult to put that in a way that's safe for people to hear, but at the same time make your point.
Mm.
You're also...
kind of inventing new ground. You know, how do you talk about ravaged faces? Well, it takes a while to come up with the idea of a ravaged face. Mm. And then there's the question of, will people know what you're saying? Because that's always a big danger, too. And then there's in 17, I think the big problem, not to get too pedantic about it, was just, how do you resolve it? Do you resolve it that the girl, that all of her acne goes away and she loses weight and she's the most popular girl in school when she turns 18? Or do you stay true to it and include the audience by the narrator stepping out?
Yeah.
And it's not that I thought of any of that while I was writing it. No, I was just writing what felt right.
Yeah. Did you, after the end of those 3 months, think, oh, I have a little beauty here. They're going to like this one.
I thought I'd written something that could be a hit song. Right. It's the only time in my life I've ever thought.
Really?
Yeah. And yet, when I started singing it, I sang it with my eyes closed because I was sure that I was the only person who'd ever felt that way, and I figured everybody would be laughing at me.
How wrong you were.
How wrong I was, thank you God, yeah.
When you realized how wrong you were, did it amaze you how much of a bond that song would create with you
and
the audience?
Still amazes me. Still to this day, it's astonishing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was never a hit anywhere but the United States. And yet, I was in Japan last year and the whole audience was singing it.
Wow.
It was just staggering.
That must be an amazing feeling.
It's amazing. It's astonishing.
And in Ireland when you sing it, the same reaction?
Yeah, but in Ireland everybody's in tune.
Right. That's a lovely reflection on us, isn't it?
It is. Well, it's a tradition of singing. I think Ireland's one of the few countries that has remembered that music is there for you to enjoy playing and enjoy listening to. You don't have to be brilliant. You don't have to be a professional. Mm. You don't have to be famous. You just have to enjoy it.
No, we love it.
Yeah.
Very, very deep.
It's a gorgeous thing.
Yeah, my favorite thing in life. The success has given you a life where you were moving in some fantastic circles, weren't you? You were writing songs and having success in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, which is the golden age, I think.
Really, yeah, it was a great age for music, for pop music anyway, and folk music.
Did I hear stories of you and Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix?
Jim Morrison and I went to the same health club.
Jim Morrison went to a health club.
He did.
Obviously not long enough.
No, it's just a pity. I knew Jimi Hendrix pretty well. And Joplin. And it's funny now because you don't expect that anybody's going to be legendary. I mean, you're just hanging out with other musicians. Like, I hung out with Dave Van Ronker with Odetta. I mean, they're just, everybody was 10 or 15 years older than me was the only thing, because I started when I was 14. So everybody else was in their mid and late 20s. But, it's odd now because they are legendary, but I don't know if they'd be legendary if they weren't dead, you know, who knows?
Okay, right.
It's a little odd to me. It's very bittersweet to think.
Did it have an effect on you to see that, you know, these people that you would have admired at the very least?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Could leave such short, tragic lives.
Yeah. Joplin used to send me home from parties when the drugs came out. And
really?
Yeah, Jimmy wouldn't let me try cocaine. Then he finally did, and I turned out to be allergic to it, and we thought I was dying, and we were going to have to take me to the hospital, and we were all going to get arrested. So it was just a horrible experience all around.
Jimi Hendrix stopping you taking cocaine. What an image.
No.
Get that girl away from that. Janice, no way.
I know, because I was a kid.
Of course.
I was so obvious. There's a huge difference between 14 and 18, or 14 and even 16.
You dropped out of music for a good few years while you were studying acting.
I did.
Why was that?
I stopped performing when I was 17 for 3 years. And then again when I was 30, I think, or 32, I just went off the road. The road plus making an album when I was a kid every 6 months. So you're on the road. Mm. You're trying desperately to write 12 great songs and then get into the studio with time enough to record them and do a good job of it and play them and learn them well enough to sing them in front of an audience and go on the road again. It beats you up. And you get to the point where you're not writing well.
Mm.
And to me, the writing is always what everything springs from and what I care about.
Yeah, it's even what the Beatles did, really, isn't it? I mean,
smart.
It wasn't compatible with maintaining any kind of artistic. You've done so many other things as well. You write as well. You write short stories.
I write short stories. I write books. I lecture. I do master classes now. I do commencement speeches for schools. I had a great time opening the Nashville Library System, which was pretty great. Yeah, I do a lot of different things.
Sounds very rewarding,
like doing a lot of things. Yeah, I love playing guitar on Mary Black's new album. I'm taking a guitar solo and singing with her.
Oh, wow, brilliant.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Great.
Herself. We're having dinner.
Brilliant. Lovely woman.
Ah, she's wonderful, isn't she? Yeah.
Her mother and my mother were great friends.
Were they?
Yeah, they were.
Oh,
they
nice.
Got from the same area of Dublin in the legends.
Yeah. So and then Frances Black, quite a good singer too.
Know her too very well indeed. You're going to do the legendary 17 for
I am
now.
Indeed. I'm going to clear my throat.